Hello again, this is Frieda Morrison, and if you've just joined us, bide wi' us. This is a programme that disna hing aboot, so we'll nae dachle. And mind, fativer why we dee it, this is a programme that celebrates the Scots language, fativer why it comes oot. We ging as far as our lugs will tak us again. In this episode, we hear fit the new Scots scriver is planning to dee in his new job. And I'm joining the throngs at Edinburgh Festival at the Assembly Rooms to watch Spectre Tune, a new play that was inspired by the Bothy Ballads of the North East and the Horseman's Word.
Dodie was troubled with the Horseman's Word ahint him. It seemed that the lasses were there for the catching, but the kirk meantime it was tightening its grip. At the new wooden kirk he had been listening to the minister enthralled. This man could preach for hours.
More about the play later. I join writer James Robertson in the Al Rope Works in Montrose to uncover more about Scotland's part in the slave trade. And Mary Bland sends us another of our epic reports for Shetland. And we've a great mix of music and art. Another back programme, Fit in Ys. We start with a new, recently appointed Scots Scriver. It's a 2-year post that's being jointly supported by Creative Scotland and the National Library of Scotland. His name is Hamish MacDonald, and I met up with Hamish in Elgin, he bides in Inverness, to thin out fit with all the possibilities and plans that could be far as he gan to start.
Well, I think the best starting point is really schools or even preschool groups and getting them to interact with a language and work creatively in a language that probably most of them will be familiar with. The way I intend to do that is that I already have a bit of a network for doing workshops in Scots in Scotland over the last 10-15 years or so.
So you're using folk you can and schools you can.
Well, there may well be a bit of that, but I think, you know, we have to broaden the aspect of the whole thing. And I'm going to be working with Matthew Fitz, Scots House Resource, which Matthew has connections with all Scotland's 32 local authorities. So that's a great way to, you know, to interact with Matthew, to use his experience, to use my experience, to get in and working with school groups. Another idea we have is to work with Lickety Spit Children's Theatre Company, based in North Edinburgh, and they work in places like Muirhouse and Drumchapel in Glasgow and Royston and places like that. Very successful theatre company, great storytellers. So there's an opportunity to go in and work with Lickety Spit as well, you know. So I think reaching as many people as we can is the key to how to get the thing rolling, you know.
Now, folk listening to this, say, the North East or even say Shetland and doing the border, say, fit it with us though. Are we going to be ignored? Is that going to be in the central belt?
Certainly not, you know. I mean, I think in the past, and you know, what I've particularly enjoyed then is, you know, I spent a term working in Dumfries and Galloway for a couple of years, from Moffat to Dumfries to Stranraer to Newton Stewart. But also after that, you know, expanded. When I got to write for Itchycoo, I did work with Matthew a wee bit in the past, and we went to Shetland, and I was involved for the last 15 years with Dogstar Theatre Company. And any time we were doing a tour out in the road with a new play, we would always try, if we could, to fund an educational element as well. So I've actually found myself doing these workshops in Caithness, in the Western Isles, in Argyllshire.
Now, when we were speaking earlier, you said your bairns went to a Gaelic-speaking school. So how can you square this off? Is there a conflict in the house when you're saying, no, I'm promoting Scots, and your bairns are speaking Gaelic?
No, at all, no. I mean, I think they're... One great aspect of them going to, or having been to Gaelic school, they're now at secondary, which isn't strictly Gaelic medium, but one great thing about them having done Gaelic education at a primary level, I think, is their appreciation of language. And I've gone in and done workshops in the Gaelic schools, and I find they get just as fascinated and active there as they do anywhere else, you know. And I think possibly having that bilingual element to add to their mindset is that they appreciate the connections of the words, you know. Because one thing I'll sometimes do is I'll show connections between Scots and Gaelic, and then between Scots and Scandinavian languages. But at a more basic level than that, sometimes when I get into primary schools, you want to involve everybody, you know. I mean, isn't it just Scots speaking bairns that are in the class? It's Polish bairns, it's bairns that have, you know, had English parents and they're not entirely familiar, but I think they find the sounds and the use of the language absolutely terrific, you know. They get energised by it, and there's subtle ways of bringing in the point that you made earlier. You know, I've got little cards that I'll stick up in front of them with wee smiley faces on them. It'll be something like, you know, Bra Nacht. What language do you think that is? And then if they don't know, tell them, well, it's you know, it's Swedish. Mm-hmm. But if you hold up this one now, Bra Nacht. You know,
so they get the connection,
and they go, well, that's Scots, you know, and they're getting connections, and they start actually saying, without me making the point, they'll say, that's Scots, mm-hmm. you know, so I don't have to tell them, they make the connection themselves, you know.
Right, I'm now going to put the spotlight on you yourself, there's folk listening to this saying, aye, but Farsi Fae.
Well, I'm Fae, I'm Fae Clydebank originally. Grew up in a typical working class Clydebank house.
Scots speaking house.
To a degree, I think, aye, you know, in a, the most natural way that it should be spoken. My mother was certainly, you know, spoke used a lot of Scots words. My dad, I think, he probably had a better range in vocabulary because his, and I think that was due to his mother, my granny, being from Aberdeenshire. So he would use words that that would be quite unique when we were young, like Welsh and Wabbit and all the rest of it. And mm-hmm. I think that's because he had that, he'd heard his mother using these words, although, you know, his mother had, and my grandfather had brought them up in Renfrew near Glasgow, you know.
Right, can you read something of your own? You've got a book here in front of you. Give us a poem of your own, Hamish.
Okay, well, these are from Itchy Q Publishing's poetry anthologies for bairns of all ages. Mm-hmm. The first book is Blethertoon Braes, which is it's an anthology of 10 different poets from different parts of Scotland, so there's a great attraction to this to me, and that you get all the different dialects, and they're quite anarchic and humorous, and I like that as well. And the listeners will not see, but they're beautifully illustrated by Beano artist called Bob Dewar. So this is called Nae Fizz Is He. Nae fizz is he's in a tizzy, cause her ginger isn't he fizzy. So she wheeks it, whirls it, wanners it, birrels it, judders it, juggles it, shimmies and shuggles it. Battering, splattering, dirling and whizzing, gain it loud the intent of the dizzen. Douche, sploosh, blooter and whoosh. Now open the cork and try the scoosh. Yuck. What? Your ginger isn't he still no fizzy, is it, is he? Aye. Then nae fizz is he falls doon dizzy. Fae try to make her ginger fizzy. So that's Nae Fizz Is He. Blethertoon has a kirkyard, and in the kirkyard there are epitaphs on the gravestones, and sometimes the public write these epitaphs to get their own back on characters who might not have been very nice to them during their lifetime. So this one's to N.F. Burton, In Memoriam, N.F. Burton. Here lieth old Nebby Features Burton. She spent all her days keeking through a net curtain, checking the neds and tutting at vandals, cloaking the neighbours and dreaming up scandals. Now, she's 6 foot ablow, is still mumphing and scoffing, because we fitted a wee windy to the lid of her coffin. One curious thing for me and very interesting thing for me is, like, you know, globalisation hasn't just homogenised language that we speak. It has in some respects, but I also think that It's given us a window into other languages and cultures that coexist with ours, and there's no reason why Scots can't thrive within that, you know, melting pot and acceptance of culture and language that you know, that this country is, and that various other, you know, just like every other country is, you know.
Hamish MacDonald, first Scots Scriver, Mayor Power to your Elbic. Thank you for this, and we'll be hearing for you otherwise through the next 2 years.
I hope so, aye. I'd be glad to keep in touch.
The new Scots Scriver, Hamish MacDonald, and we'll be hearing a lot mair for Hamish, I'm sure, or best wishes in the new post. Music new, for a CD card Moonshine, for a partnership card Up in the Air, featuring Johnny Hardy, Gavin Marwick and Davy Carnach. This is called Duffel House and Eileen Currens. called Duffel Hoose and Eileen Curran's via CD card Moonshine, featuring Johnny Hardy, Gavin Marwick and Davy Catenach. And that CD came out in 2012, and I've only just found it. It's a cracker. Now, last episode, me, myself and my co-presenter, Steve Byrne, were speaking about a new play called Spectre Tune, that was, according to the publicity spiel, was inspired by the bothy ballads of the Northeast and the Horseman's Word. I read for the programme notes. Playwright Elspeth Turner and acclaimed director Matthew Lenton explore the fraying boundaries between past, present and future, weaving poetry, Doric, wild horses and song, and recordings for the archives for the School of Celtic and Scottish Studies. The play stars Elspeth, Bridget McCann, Matt Regan and Mark Wood, and I went to see the play at the Assembly Rooms in Edinburgh, part of the festival, and I enjoyed it, but I have to admit it takes a bit of thinking about. After the play, I spoke to the writer Elspeth Turner about her work, but as I was sitting out in the courtyard by day waiting for Elspeth after the play, the lad that plays twa of the main parts in the play, Doddy and Stanley, Mark Wood, just happened to come over and sit down for a blether. Mark was in a hurry, as you'll hear, but I got him to tell me a bit about himself.
My name's Mark Wood, I'm from Torrett in Aberdeen.
Okay, what part do you play in the play?
I play Doddy West and Stanley as well, so two parts within the show.
Where did you train?
I trained at the All RSMD, so All Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama. It's now called RCS, Royal Conservatoire of Scotland. So I was there from 2002 to 2005. And then for that, I'd done quite a few plays in Scotland and a few tours around the UK. Then I got some good telly work, so I moved down south for a bit. I was in London for about 6 and a bit years. Working, doing theatre, TV, film, back and forth up the road, obviously. Just wherever the work is, I suppose.
So do you think the fact that you can speak Scots has come in handy, or has it been a drawback?
I think it's been a great strength, actually, because there's some parts I've got are purely because of who, you know, who I am. A couple of things, like any casting you go for is a breakdown, and it's a lot of the breakdowns now that just say they might have a picture of somebody who they want them to look like, for instance, like a Jack Whitehall or Jack Black or something like that. So it can be anyone. So if you go in, a lot of the time they quite like that you're different, or, you know, they like different voices. And
now we've just been through the play together.
Aye.
You were playing Doddy West and Stanley. I'm still thinking about the play. I have to be honest. There's so much in it. I didn't get far to start. What's it all about?
So it's basically about how life in all years, a lot of people are wasn't it like that mad pace. Obviously, new Aberdeen. Aberdeen's a lot to go through, and a massive change. Obviously, with the oil boom in the late 60s, 70s, and that. But now we're at what a big change coming up. Where Abdi's getting made redundant. So, it's all about change. It's about how a city changes, how the people change. Sort of the countryside versus the tunes of folk, if you will. So it's about that and the legacy of Fitz left behind of people and a farm and land, because there's not a lot of folk of that stock left, you know what I mean, for actually really working the land, and it's all changed.
Did you need the bothy ballads in it? Did you need that the recurring voices coming out of the archives of the School of Scottish Studies? Do you think that lent it?
I think it did. I think it brings a different sort of texture, I suppose. There's a different quality to it. I mean, if you listen to a lot of that stuff online, it's just amazing when you hear it, the recordings, and you just close your eyes and it's almost like you're sitting there with the manies listening to them, you know what I mean? But then with this, obviously you've got the bothy ballads, and it's inspired by that, and a lot of the bothy ballads were just about telling stories, Ken, if it happened to people.
And it's all about stories.
It is, it's all about stories. That's all it is. Acting's just playing at shops, you can, that's all it is. You know what I mean?
Acting's just playing at shops.
Playing at shops, aye.
Right, Matt, can you tell me fit why you have to go on and catch a train?
I've got to... sorry, folks, I've got a head down the road now. I'm wanting us off because my mate's fixing my bathroom for me. And he's in my house on his own. And I got no drink, thankfully. So
he's needed the ranger right. Drinks, Gubbin.
No, okay. I didn't get enough of that.
Well,
so.
Congratulations, a great performance. Oh, I really
enjoyed
it. I'm still thinking about it. Elspeth's just about to join us, as well. So, well, here, I'll be there with her.
Nice to meet you.
And you.
Thanks, guys.
We'll
see you
again.
See you.
Cheers. Elspeth. Right. Mark has to go because Apala is in his bathroom sorting his plumbing.
He's sorry. That's not a euphemism.
No. Well, I never thought about that.
Right. He's in his new house sign.
Here we go. We've been speaking about Fit Mark since it's our boot.
Aye.
Now, I'm going to take a few days to think about it myself.
Aye.
Is that intentional? Do you want to make folks think about it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think it's best if people leave the theatre with questions, you know, and questions of themselves and of the world around them, and that something about the show has reached them on several levels.
Right.
I
think you press buttons in folk. That's what you're doing, isn't it?
I do. I don't mind if it's provocative, if that's what you're saying, yeah.
Right. And then, you see, I'm a simple kind of soul, to be absolutely honest.
Well, simple. We all are at heart.
And I thought I was coming to hear a translation or a dramatic version of a bothy ballad.
Oh, I see.
See? And it's nae that, is it? Well, it is that and it's nae that.
Well, it is in a way, I think, because those bothy ballads seem to tell the story of people's everyday lives and events that go on in their everyday lives. They're told in quite a straightforward manner. I think they're not like sort of highly poetic the way some of the play gets. Mm. But that's the way I've expressed what seems to be happening in the bothy ballads, especially songs being sung about women by the men or from a woman's perspective, but still written by a man. And I wanted to get underneath that a bit and explore it.
Right, Fid, why did you choose this subject? You're near to the northeast.
No, so my mother is from Portsoy, so I've spent some time in the northeast over the years.
Ah, right. Got
yeah, it. So she was born and raised there, and I often go up to a cottage there still to write. Huh? And so I've been there at certain times and just digging around in the local library and whatnot.
Muddling a boot, as they say up there.
Muddling a boot, aye. And I was just reading a book about the social history of the northeast, and I came across a section about the Horseman's Word. Mm-hmm. And I was very intrigued by that because it seemed very dark and Masonic, and it had a sort of quite theatricality to it.
There's a magical thing about it, though,
exactly,
isn't it?
Exactly. And I'm really interested in the supernatural and things and exploring that in my writing. And then reading more and more about the folk of the northeast and talking to my mum about it, they weren't known to be as superstitious as the folk, say, out of the west, where my father's people are from. They were sort of more practical people and
supposed
more rooted in this,
supposedly.
But then when you dig in a little bit, actually, they have roots in lots of pagan rituals and things to do with the land, and it's because they're so dependent on the land for their livelihood.
You can't help but notice the stone circles.
That's
the key to it, isn't it?
Yes. So I was very interested in that. And then how, when the church moved in, especially the Free Kirk, how everything started to change a bit, and it had
especially
a real effect.
Absolutely,
because what made a real stronghold there was the Episcopal Church, and kind of that butting up against the Free Kirk. And I mean, in Portsoy there's still four or five church buildings standing, although they're not all in use now. But anyway, I find that really interesting, where the supernatural meets religion. Mm-hmm. And how it has an impact on the people working the land, the ordinary folk. So I started trying to explore that, and then one day I was wandering about Aberdeen, because I have a good friend that lives there, and I witnessed an incident in a charity shop which really piqued my interest between some of the volunteers, and I thought that would be an interesting setting for a play, and also juxtaposed with this old rural, simpler, quote unquote, farming life.
Okay. I'm not going to give too much away, because you want folk to come and see the play and enjoy the play. But you start off in the charity shop, then you go into another scene with the horseman and his
And his love.
His love, Meg. Then you come back and forth, rooting in the charity shop. Am I right? This is my translation. This is my simple translation. I've got to think about it hard. What would you want folk to go on and think about especially? What's your main theme there? Is there a main theme?
actually, I want folk to be able to follow the story. Mm-hmm. I would like people to empathise with these characters, both in the 1890s farm town mm-hmm. and in the present day. What people take away from it, I think, is really up to them. I try not to sort of decide or dictate that in advance. I think I'll just like tell the story in the best way I know how, and then leave that up to people what they take away from it. Because you see, each audience member will take away something totally different, and that's what interests me about theatre.
Now, you've got a long run here.
Yes.
The seagulls are enjoying this as well. You've got a long run here at the Assembly Halls, and then you're going, our place in the Northeast. Mm. A lot of tours set up there in September, so folk can see this.
Fantastic, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Looking forward to that.
We're going all over the place, and I'm especially looking forward to taking it into the Northeast, into Village Halls. Yeah, we're going all the way up to Bucky and Wood End Barn in Bankery, and we'll be in Aberdeen itself for three shows, which is great.
Okay, I'm going to add my congratulations and my best wishes.
Well, thank you very much. Nice chatting to you.
Elspeth Turner, writer and actress. And Elspeth's play, as you heard there, is touring all around Scotland this month. So go online and find out far and fan. Spectre Town. This is a song for the Greg Duncan Folk Song Collection for the North East, sung by one of my favourite trad singers, Alison McMorland, for her album Cloudberry Day. This is The American Stranger.
I'm a stranger in this country, from America I hail. No one here knows me or can tell to me my name. In this strange country I'll remain here a while, far from my darling for many a mile. I have travelled this country, both early and late. My hardships have been many, my trials have been great. I courted a fair lassie, but she me has disowned. Yet determined through this wide world, with my love I will roam. Some say that I am rakish, some say that I'm wild, some say that I am guilty, fair maidens to beguile. But I will prove them liars if she'll go along with me to the plains of America, my darling to be. And the sun that's in the firmament, may it give no more light. And the stars in the elements may fall in one night. The rocks they rend asunder, and the mountains they may move, before that I prove false to the girl that I love. And the ship that's in the ocean, may it sail without sail. And the smallest of fishes turn into large whales. In the middle of the ocean there may grow a myrtle tree, before that I prove false to the girl that loves me. It's they have got married and away they have set sail. May all good attend them with a fine and pleasing gift.
Alison McMorland and the American Stranger for their album Cloudberry Day. Now, I was in Montrose a couple of weeks ago to see a national art show set to meditate on the theme of empire. The exhibition was in the old ropeworks. A sound installation by Carlin Scott called Considered Cargo was part of that exhibition.
Considered Cargo.
One of the Negroes had a slave on board with his hands tied behind his back, and a girl of about 4 years of age, which our captain purchased from them. This night was the first time that we began to make any transaction in what is called the slave trade.
As you heard there, the sound installation focused on the part played by the northeast of Scotland, in particular Montrose, with the slave trade.
To give anything like a narrative of the distress, hardships and cruelties that I underwent while on board of this ship, and I saw inflicted on others, is almost beyond the power of language to describe. It is to be observed that the Negroes, as soon as they are taken on board of the ship in this trade, they are circumcised. And to add more to the misery of these poor wretches, they are bound with heavy shackles of iron, and every 10 are chained together by the necks, hand and feet, and marked with a burnt iron on the right hip.
Just harrowing stories. Well, I've been steeped in the slave trade this last few weeks, listening to Sir Tom Devine deliver his lecture in the debating chamber at the Scottish Parliament about Scotland's part in the slave trade, and the talk was part of the Scotland in Politics series. And it's a topic that, as Sir Tom said, has been subject to national amnesia for decades. We have not spoken about it much till now. Writer James Robertson provided some of the dialogue for that sound installation you heard earlier, and I met up with James in Montrose prior to his talk about a novel he wrote called Joseph Knight that's linked to the Scottish slave trade. Before we speak about the novel, James describes where we're at.
We are in the old ropeworks in Montrose, which the ropeworks is no longer a factory, but it's been taken over by a wonderful woman called Kim Canally, who is really turning it into an art gallery. And it's a beautiful building, very long building as it needed to be when they
beautiful
were making rope.
Artworks on the walls everywhere.
That's right. Well, she has a whole range of exhibitions, but this particular one is organised by the Society of Scottish Artists, and the title of the exhibition is Empire, and it's really a whole range of different artists who are all looking at different aspects of empire and what the word empire means, and maybe going a wee bit deeper into it than that, also what the wider implications of that word empire mean to us today.
I'm going to come back on that, but I'm going to still go through the nuts and bolts of why and where. We've got the where, but why are we here?
Well, the exhibition the space was available in Montrose, but there's a particular reason as well, is that Montrose, like so many other ports in up and down the east-west coast of Scotland, and indeed the hail of the British Isles, was absolutely founded and built on trade. And trade is an integral part of empire. So Montrose, a lot of the wealth of Montrose was built on some of the things that were happening during the period of the British Empire. And one of the things that was happening was that a great number of Montrose ships were coming and going from this very place on as part of the slave trade. At one point in the 18th century, there were 30 ships trading in the transatlantic trade, taking slaves from Africa across to the Caribbean or North America, bringing products like tobacco and sugar and rum back to the British Isles, and then taking other products like dried fish and salmon and timber to Europe, and then going on from there to Africa. So it was a triangular trade, and there were people in Montrose involved in that for many, many decades.
For Montrose, of course, Aberdeen and further north, all of the northeast.
It wasn't just Montrose, it was, as you say, all of the northeast.
Dundee.
And up and down the coast, both the east coast and the west coast, many, many folk were making their living.
And their fortunes as well, James.
Absolutely.
I was listening to the narrative that you were involved in downstairs, And I was surprised to hear in that narrative that it really started about 1740. And I'm trying to put this in context of what Scotland would have looked like at that time. That's pre-Culloden.
It's pre-Culloden, and in fact, the trade with the Caribbean had been going for some time before that. It really takes off after the union with England in 1707, because up until that point, the Scots had not been able to trade with the English colonies in North America and the Caribbean. After 1707, the colonies are open to the Scots to trade with. And so the Scottish engagement with the slave trade really takes off in the 18th century. Then you've got, middle of the century, you've got the Jacobite risings, and so there's a wee bit of a hiatus. But after that, so however, then suddenly it takes off again. And by the late 18th century, the Scots are up to their oxters in the, not just the slave trade, the transportation of slaves from Africa to the Americas, but also in running the plantations on islands like Jamaica. Jamaica was kent as a Scottish island.
No, that brings me back to Fitwy were here, and Fitwy you're here in particular, because that tax in Fit you're going to be speaking about later on this evening. Tell us about that, James.
Well, about 15 years ago, I discovered, more or less by accident, a story that I hadn't kent before. And I was a history student at Edinburgh in the 1970s, and then I went back and did a second degree in history. And in that one, I was studying the Scottish Enlightenment in the 18th century. And yet, even there, I didn't come across the story of Joseph Knight. And it was really by a wee accident that I came across the story. After my first novel had been published, a friend from Dundee came up to me and handed me a wee photocopy, a history book of Dundee, in which Joseph Knight was mentioned.
No, can I just repeat that name again? Because a lot of folk will never have heard a Joseph Knight,
right,
or the book that you wrote.
Right. Well, Joseph Knight was the given name, or the name given to him, of a slave, a young laddie that was taken from the west coast of Africa when he was about 10 years old, on the notorious Middle Passage across to Jamaica. There he was sold into slavery, bought by a Scottish planter called John Wedderburn, who originally came from Dundee. Wedderburn had been a Jacobite. That's a very complicated story. After another 10 years, Joseph was brought back to Scotland by Wedderburn and became a kind of house slave or house servant in his estate in Perthshire.
Can I go back a wee bitty?
Mm-hmm.
John Wedderburn, he took flight after Culloden, as a lot of folk did, and I suppose found refuge in Jamaica. Was it Jamaica?
Well, aye, we're not quite sure how he got to Jamaica. I mean, John Wedderburn was a young laddie of 16, 17 year old when he was at Culloden. He was there with his father. His father was captured and was horribly executed in London for his involvement with the Jacobite rebellion. John fled the country, maybe went to Europe to begin with. At some point, he managed to get across the Atlantic to America, and then he ended up in Jamaica, where it seems he was joined by his brother, James. They seem to have traded for a while as doctors, even though they didn't have any training, any medical training at all. And then they set themselves up as planters. And like many other folk there, it was relatively easy to acquire land. Once you'd acquired land and had, if you had a wee bit of siller, you could get, you could buy slaves. Once you had slaves, you could start to grow sugar. Sugar cane was the main crop. And it was basically a license to print money, because the demand for sugar was enormous back in the British Isles. Not just for sugar, but for the byproduct of sugar, rum. Mm-hmm. So once you'd managed to get a foothold in this trade, that the profits that you could make were absolutely huge.
So John Wedderburn came back a wealthy man, mm-hmm, and took Joseph Knight with him as his servant.
As his servant, I suppose it was kind of fashionable then to have a black servant in your house, you know, in sort of done out in your family outfit. And so that was really how Joseph came to be in Scotland. But he clearly was an intelligent young lad, and he didn't want to be anybody's slave. And he had learned to read and write, or been taught to read and write, and he had discovered that there had been a slave in England who had managed to win his freedom by refusing to go back from England back to America with his maester. And Joseph decided that if that was good enough for a slave in England, then maybe he had a chance to win his freedom in Scotland through the Scottish legal system. And so he basically challenged John Wedderburn to defend his right to own him.
But was there any bit? I mean, I have to come clean to this, and I read this book while I was sitting on a beach in Turkey somewhere. I took your book all the way to Turkey. Aye. And I was just enthralled with the whole thing. And I could see it. You're writing pictures, of course.
Aye.
And I'm sure I'm not the first person to say this would make a fantastic film. But back to the story again. Back to the story again. Am I right in saying that Joseph Knight escaped or ran off and hid in Fife, wasn't it?
Well, again, this is where it's, you know, I ended up writing it as a novel because there were bits and pieces missing from the historical record that I had to fill in the spaces. Basically, Joseph had had a liaison with one of the housemaids in the big house, and she was pregnant. So he went to John Wedderburn and said, I need to have a proper living wage so I can look after my wife and bairn. And Wedderburn refused to let him go and refused to pay him a wage. And that's when Joseph ran away. And he was apprehended by Wedderburn's pals, the Justices of the Peace for Perthshire. So it seemed that his initial bid for freedom had come to an end, but he appealed against being arrested. And the Sheriff of Perth said, no, nobody can be a slave in Scotland. And this is in about 1765, 69, 70. Nobody can be a slave in Scotland. So there was a battle royal started through the legal system as to whether you could or couldn't be owned by anybody else. He basically spent four or five years where he had left the service of his maester, but hadn't actually won his freedom. And we're not quite sure where he went to, but his wife was from Dundee, so we think that they probably stayed in Dundee for that period. And it must have been sair times for them because an awful lot of folk wouldn't have wanted to tax sides with him against a powerful man like John Wedderburn. Right. We're talking about the 1770s. This is 30 years before the abolition of slavery.
So the abolition was 1838, something about that. Eventually,
1830s is when slavery gets abolished in the colonies. Mm-hmm. But in Scotland, the Joseph Knight case establishes that you can't be a slave in Scotland in 1778. So you're talking about 50 years before slavery was abolished in the colonies.
But we've folk to read the book and find out what happens in the end.
Aye.
James, I'm looking forward to your speaking about this later on. Here's to the next.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, I believe we're going to get a good crowd, and with a bit of luck, we'll have some good questions and so on. I think that Montrose, as you say, is a very historical place. You can feel it coming off the walls in this place.
Can't indeed, can you? I'm going to want to look at some of the pictures.
Bra.
Writer James Robertson and that book, Joseph Knight, is published by the Fourth Estate Limited. It's £10 in paperback and it's on Kindle. And it's a great read. Thoroughly recommended. This is The Slave's Lament by Robert Burns, sung by Emily Smith.
See it more, and alas, charming coast. Is nae bitter snow and frost like the lands of Virginia, Virginia. Their streams forever flow, and their fillers forever blow. And alas, I am weary, weary home. Their streams forever flow, and their fillers forever blow. And alas, I am weary, weary
Emily Smith with The Slave's Lament by Robert Burns, and that's from an album called Ah Adam's Bairns, produced by Fred Freeman for the National Library of Scotland, and it was recorded here in this very studio by Oor Ritchie. And nay only that, the lineup for that song sung, the voice was Emily Smith, of course, as you heard, Sitton, Aaron Jones, Small Pipes, Frank McLaughlin, and Jombie, Richard Werner. Oor Ritchie is on this album. And the other enlightening thing is that in Fred's notes about that song, he actually makes reference to Joseph Knight and that court accession ruling that ruled in favour of Joseph Knight. What links? Are Jiny up bits? Now, but this time, I would normally be in deep, meaningful confabs with my co-presenter Steve Byrne, but the man is on holiday. And it's just me and our aforementioned soon sorter here the day. Are you there, Richie?
I'm over here, Fida. How are you doing?
Okay, fine. But we're just making sure you are there.
I'm good.
See, you mentioned in that song in that album, Jombie, recorded
there,
here.
There you go.
Fitanice.
A man of many talents.
Fitanice. Well, we didn't hear Steve, but we've got Mary Blansby Shetland to fill that slot. Only Mary Blansby Shetland could fill that slot. And Mary's been to the theatre, and this is her report.
What onkens for Shetland? Well, how about this?
Herring to sell!
Yes, a herring to sell!
Herring to sell!
Yes, a herring to sell!
Herring to sell!
Yes, a herring to sell! Ring the bell, yes, ring the
bell! Herring for sale. A Shetland song and something of a classic. One of several to emerge with the original Shetland dialect musical Telwys in 1958. Shetland Forwards recently revived it with a full cast of 35. It tells the Lerwick story, for the days of the whaling, the time of the herring boom, and back when water came for the well, not for a tap. Christian Tate was musical director.
You get everything for the comical to the touching and arousing and everything. It's just absolutely lovely, very entertaining and rewarding to do. And what I liked about the whole show was that, firstly, as a Lerwick lass, it was about Lerwick, which pleased me no end. And it was fine because the songs we could do in a sort of a standardised form of dialect, because everybody has to be the same when they're singing and sing with one voice. But what I also liked was the fact that the script allowed for folk fae arts to take part and just speak in their own particular tongue, because they were all coming in to go to the whaling or this and that. And it gave scope for such a lot of different versions of the dialect, and everyone natural and right in its place.
This was written at the time when musicals were at their height, and we had Rodgers and Hammerstein, we had all the double acts of all the musicals. And here in Shetland, Kay and Matheson, they did achieve something special, didn't they?
They certainly did, and it stood the test of time, it really has. Lovely, lovely melodies, and nice rhythms.
Some linguistic adjustments were needed, and there were a glossary in the programme, which is where Lorraine Johnson comes in.
I think in 1958, some things were nearer in time. The herring fishing, for example, they were still folk guttering in the 1950s. But now, it's very, very much a thing of the past. And although the scenes were set in the early 1900s, folk still kent what gutters did, what farlings were, and that sort of thing. And so here you need a pretty bit of glossary help.
How did they choose things?
I think I just look at to see what maybe was a key word, that if you didn't understand that, you would have missed something. You couldn't have possibly put in every single word to cope with folk that's really completely new to the dialect, but you did need a bit of help for folk here and there. The title of a song, like Bannocks and Bursting and Brunies, missed folk would ken where the Bannock was. Some folk will ken where the Brunie is, but very, very few folk will ken what Bursting is. And I never ever kent mysel when I saw it first.
And what is it?
It's mill made for corn, dried in a kettle over a fire. So it's a long time for anybody rocked with that.
Was there any work where you actually needed to change the words just to make it more accessible to 2015?
They were the entrance saying here and there. I mind in particular their, what would you call it, an imprecation at one of the whalers when they're being summoned to the ship, says to the mate, about the skipper, what might sit at the die sheiks and so hissings, because he's come with this bad news. Now, this is not an easy expression to explain to anybody who lives in the modern day, so eventually we just changed it, because it was kind of difficult to mind and say.
And what did you change it to?
Devil tak beth Hammond dee.
Plans are new in hand to make a DVD of Telwys, so Shetland dialect's still alive and well, so far, in songs like this one.
God bless thee.
Ach, a That just does your hair, Gwaed. That report for Shetland, for Mary Blance. There's nobody like Mary Blance, and of course there's nobody else like Shetland. And that's just about all we can fit into this episode. Fit mair could you want, apart fae. A tribute to the winners of this year's World Pipe Band Championship. I'll say cheery bye. So does O'Soon Sorter.
Cheery bye.
And he's got a sair ankle. He's gonna know his ankle. Didn't I ask how? He just gonna know his ankle. Thanks for being with us. Join us again and tell folk about the programme. Let them tune in and enjoy it. www.scotsradio.com. I'll do that again. www.scotsradio.com. And just leave them to enjoy, I think. For me, Frieda Morrison, and Richie Werner, we say our uncle, buy the new. This is the World Champion Pipe Band 2015 Shots and Dyke Head with our Caledonian medley.